Section of our course, which is about different interpretations of quantum theory. These are the interpretations I plan to cover. Definitely today we'll be talking about de Broglie-Bohm. Tomorrow we'll talk about many worlds, probably most of the lecture, maybe all of the lecture. I will try and squeeze in something about spontaneous collapse theories, maybe only a couple of slides. And then on Friday we'll talk about things which are related to Copenhagen in some way. Okay, so today we're going to talk about de Broglie-Bohm, but before we do that, I want to give a bit of an overview. So Adam Cabello wrote a paper recently called Quantum Interpretations, a Map of the Madness, kind of like that phrase. Now, you can classify interpretations in a variety of different ways. Are they local or are they non-local, et cetera, et cetera. So any categorization you choose is limited in some sense. But from the point of view of stuff that we've been studying, there's an interesting distinction between realist, straightforwardly realist interpretations, and ones which are more sort of Copenhagen style, anti-realist in some sense. And then there's a distinction we talked about between psi epistemic and psi ontic. Now, of course, there are no ontological models that's a psi epistemic, or at least not maximally psi epistemic. There's no fully worked out interpretation that's psi epistemic at all in that category. And if you're being Copenhagen-ish, you are being anti-realist about the microphysical world. And so therefore, the wave functions which describe the microphysical world can't possibly be states of reality. Now, most of the interpretations the interpretations that everybody talks about that are realist are these three. There are many more you can find in the literature. It's like there are many sort of more minor interpretations which have less subscribers, if you like. So the ones that are considered usually the important realist ones are these top two here, which are straightforwardly ontological models in the sense that they can fit into that framework. And so therefore, they're subject to all of those constraints. They're psiontic, they're non-local, et cetera. Then there are attempts to break out of the ontological models framework. I regard this as myself the most promising route to realism because it enables you to, for instance, save locality, perhaps. The many worlds interpretation is the best known. This one here, which I'm calling the ironic many worlds, this is something of my own devising, which I may explain at the end of tomorrow's lecture. There's also an older thing called quantum logical realism, which was popular briefly in the 1960s, mostly among philosophers, and then has been dismissed since then, I think, a little too quickly. But I won't have time to talk about that. You can look it up if you want. Now, on the Copenhagenish side, it's kind of like everybody who writes a Copenhagenish interpretation writes a slightly different one, so there are dozens and dozens of them. Here I've just listed, as well as original Copenhagen, some which are relatively prominent today, like their proponents are writing about them today. And some of these, it turns out that you can actually rule out via a mathematical theorem, and I'll discuss that on Friday, but some of them are still standing. Another very prominent interpretation is the consistent histories or decoherent histories interpretation. I don't know where to put it, primarily because the different proponents of that interpretation have very different ideas about what it's about. So some people, Robert Griffith in particular, would put it up here. It's an attempt to go beyond the standard kind of ontology, and clearly is supposed to be like a probability theory. Some people view it as a way to define the worlds in an Everett interpretation, so it could go here. And some people view it as saying within a Copenhagen interpretation when you can say that a measurement has effectively happened. So it could go in all of those places. But I don't think it has a very clear, well-defined ontology. It's more of a mathematical formalism that you can apply in various different ways. Okay, so if you want to know about any of these other ones that I won't have time to talk about in more detail, then you can ask me and I can give you pointers to the literature. Okay, so what we're going to talk about today is the de Broglie-Bohm theory, a very brief history. It was first discovered by de Broglie in the 1920s or so, actually while he was doing his PhD. And he wrote down a set of equations, which we now recognize as the first order form of the theory. He wrote down these equations, and then he brushed them off immediately. He said, well, this theory is obviously non-local. It's not Lorentz invariant. It takes place on configuration space rather than involving waves in real 3D space. So obviously, this theory isn't right, but you know it would work. And so then he went on to try and develop something else, which turned out not to work. And so that whole thing was forgotten, dismissed by de Broglie and forgotten by everybody else. It was rediscovered by David Bohm. And most people, when they saw that, thought that this was the original discovery, and hence it's often called Bohmian mechanics. Should be called the Broglie-Bohm theory, but there's a good reason why people would still call it Bohmian mechanics, which is that absolutely nobody in the English-speaking world knows how to pronounce de Broglie, including myself, so I may sometimes slip into calling it Bohmian mechanics. So this was a different form of it in terms of second-order differential equations that looked a bit more like Newtonian mechanics. But then the forgotten de Broglie form was picked up by John Bell in the 1970s and 80s. That's the version that I think is most easy to understand. That's the version I'm going to present today. But there are still people out there who think you should do it in second-order form. Now, there's a whole book you can read if you want a more comprehensive overview of this kind of approach. Okay, so let's remember what at least two of the goals of an interpretation was. One was we should provide an ontology, so a statement of what exists and how it behaves, what's out there. And secondly, we need to save the phenomena. So we need to explain, in terms of that ontology, why do we see the quantum predictions, and why do we see the classical world in our everyday life. So Bohmians typically divide the ontology into two further pieces. They talk about the primitive ontology. So there are certain things that constitute the world that we directly experience. Okay. So usually in this kind of camp, it's assumed that the primitive ontology has to consist of things that are localized in space-time. Right? So we experience a world of things, chairs, tables, etc., that appear to be localized in space-time. Right? They say, well, the easiest way to explain that is if there are really things that are localized in space-time, and those are called local beables in John Bell's terminology. So in the de Broglie-Bohm theory, the local beables are particles that have definite trajectories in space. There isn't a good word, but there's the rest of the ontology. You might call it secondary ontology, if you like. But there could be several levels of ontology, of course. This is whatever other stuff you need to determine how the primitive ontology behaves, right? So in order to compute what's going to happen in the measurement outcome, it might be that there's some additional stuff I need beyond this. And in the Bohmian theory, that's going to be the quantum state. So here on one slide is basically the entire theory. I could stop the lecture after this slide, but you might be confused about what it all means. So here's some notation. There's going to be various different types of vectors that are thrown around. So when I write Q, this denotes a vector in R3. This is something like the position of an individual particle or the momentum of an individual particle. So when there's an arrow over it, I mean that. And when I write in bold, I mean a vector in configuration space. So if you have n particles, then if you list the position vectors of all of the n particles as a vector, that will have this many components. Okay, so these bold things denote configuration space points. Okay, so let's start with spinless particles, spinless non-relativistic particles. We can write a quantum state as a wave function on configuration space. Okay, so the wave function, which is a function of the positions of all of the variables and time in principle. It's just the inner product of the position eigenstates, the configuration space eigenstates with the quantum state. Okay, so you're familiar, that's just the position representation. Now, the wave function obeys the Schrodinger equation, and that's true also in this theory. It's just the standard Schrodinger equation. And normally, we'll be talking about the non-relativistic Hamiltonian, where you have, you know, p squared over 2m terms for each particle, kinetic energy, plus thus the potential. Now, so that's standard. What's new is that in the Bohmian theory, we add that the particle that there is an actual point in configuration space occupied by the system. Okay, so this distinction is crucial here. When I'm using a small q here, I mean a function over all of configuration space. Large q means the configuration space point actually occupied by the system. Okay, so each particle has a position, basically. Okay, so then what we need is a time evolution equation for these actual configuration space points, and this is it, basically. So that's just the equation. So here, this nabla here is a 3D vector. So this is the, you know, you're taking derivatives just of the kth particle coordinates here. And this whole thing, this whole function here is going to be a function on configuration space, and we evaluate it at the point occupied by the system. Okay, so bear in mind here that this is, in principle, because these are all functions of configuration space, this theory is highly non-local, because this velocity here of the kth particle depends on all of the positions of all of the other particles in configuration space. So if you have two separated particles and I move this particle, then the velocity of this particle will change. Okay. So this has like an instantaneous action of, at a distance encoded in it, this kind of equation. Okay, so that equation is there's one more part of Bohmian mechanics, and then I'll explain where that equation comes from. So there's one more postulate that you require if you're going to obtain the same predictions as standard quantum theory, and this is called the quantum equilibrium hypothesis. Okay, so we have actual particle configurations, and what we're going to do is we're going to assign a probability density to the particle configurations. So this hypothesis says that at some initial time, the probability density of the system for occupying configuration point q is just the usual mod squared probabilities. So this is the wave function evaluated at time t0 here. Then what you can show is that under this evolution here and the Schrodinger evolution taken together, if this is your probability density at the initial time, then you will have that probability density at all other times, where you're evaluating it with respect to the wave function at that time. So in other words, the probability density, if you start it out with the usual quantum probability density, it will track that probability density over time. That's called equivariance. It's a little bit of a similar concept to thermal equilibrium. So in thermal equilibrium, in classical statistical mechanics, there is a probability distribution that if you're in that probability distribution, you don't change in time, okay? This is a slight generalization of that. The probability density does change in time, but it always tracks the wave function, okay? So it doesn't ever do anything else. Okay, so what does this probability density mean? There's a little bit of controversy about that, because in principle, the way that you're supposed to apply this theory is that, you know, you just have a wave function for the entire universe, and then you have one configuration space point, which represents the positions of all the particles in the universe. So that's in principle what you have. How do you make sense of a probability density if there's only one configuration space point? So there's, you know, lots of literature on that, but roughly speaking, this is how we'll understand it today. If I prepare a large number of identical systems in identical quantum states, then what I mean is that, you know, if I look at the where the particles are in each of those state preparations and calculate the probability density of those configurations, it will be the quantum one. So note here that the quantum state is playing two independent roles here. It's governing the dynamics, okay? It appears in this guidance equation. And secondly, it's used to set the probability density. And those two are independent. I could change one without changing the other. Okay, so that's gonna be important later. Okay, so now where does this guidance equation come from? Well, if you start from the Schrodinger equation, then you all, I hope, know from undergraduate quantum mechanics that there's a continuity equation, right? So if we take this as our probability density, and then there's a probability current, which satisfies a continuity equation. Yeah.
Could you go back one slide, please?
Yeah.
I don't completely understand what you mean by the universe has only one single configuration space point.
Configuration space consists of the positions of. So if you have m particles, configuration space consists of a specification of the positions of each particle.
Yes.
Right? So if we take the wave function of the entire universe and the configuration space of all of the particles in the universe, then in Bohmian mechanics, there is one configuration space point occupied by the universe. Right? It just says each particle in the universe at any time has a definite position.
Yes.
That's what I mean.
What's the problem with that?
Well, the problem with that depends. I mean, I'm trying to avoid getting too much into thorny issues over the interpretation of probability. But often in physics, when we talk about probabilities, we think about ensembles, right? We think about frequentist probabilities and ensembles. So here, there's only one configuration space point, yet I need to make sense of the idea that the probability density of the configurations in the universe is something.
So we can't just prepare the universe again and again in the same states, but that doesn't necessarily mean that nothing can.
Right. I mean, look, I don't think there's a big problem with this, but you need an interpretation of what that probability means.
So your point is just that you're taking frequentist approach to probabilities.
For today, I mean, it doesn't really matter, right? The point is, you can interpret these probabilities in whatever way you normally interpret classical probabilities, it's fine, right? And I'm just sort of giving here a rough sort of frequentist idea of what it means in that particular case, just so that you have something something more concrete to think about. But you don't have to interpret it that way. You can interpret them as Bayesian probabilities if you like, or as objective chances in some ways, it's fine.
So it predicts probabilities without saying what probabilities have to mean.
Well, so does classical physics. When I write down statistical mechanical distribution in classical physics, physicists disagree on what that means, right? There are different approaches to statistical mechanics, and people argue about it. My only point here is that it matters here only to the same extent that it matters there. Treat these probabilities in the same way as you would treat classical statistical mechanical probabilities, however that is. When we talk about many worlds tomorrow, we'll have to get a bit more sophisticated about probability. But for now, it's just these are ordinary classical probabilities, if you like. Did you have a comment, David?
I was going to ask how Bohmian mechanics deals with subspaces. It doesn't make much sense to me to try to describe a subset of the universe if what's going on there depends on positions of everything else. I guess if there's no
entanglement. Wait until later in the lecture and we'll get to that. Okay, so I want to explain where this comes from. So at least this is John Bell's approach to deriving it. So here we have the continuity equation. You can derive this from the Schrodinger equation. Okay, this is something you do in undergraduate quantum mechanics. We have a probability current, so this is now a probability current in configuration space. So there's a current for each of the n particles, and that's given by this formula. So this is something that you should have derived in undergraduate quantum mechanics. Okay, so normally we consider this probability current as representing just the flow of probability, right? We don't interpret it in any other way. The idea in the Bohmian theory is to consider this as a flow of particle density, right? So the idea here is, like, consider one of these ensemble preparations. Each of them only has one configuration space point in them, but let's sort of lump them all together and consider a density of trajectories that we would get from putting all of these preparations, you know, on top of each other, right? So then you would have some kind of particle density, which we know obeys this, and we want to consider the current now as a flow of that particle density rather than just a flow of probability. Okay, so a current, a particle flux, doesn't uniquely specify particle trajectories, right? Because a current just tells you about the net flow of particles. So if I have like 5 particles going this way and 3 particles going that way, then the net current would be 2, right? 2 particles going that way, right? But what we're going to do here is sort of take the simplest idea, which is to imagine fluid flow. So in fluid flow, at every point in the river, for example, there's a unique velocity for a particle at that point, right? So the velocity field is just a function of, in other words, the velocity field is just a function of space, and it's not a function of the momentum of the particle. Okay, so if we make that hypothesis, as in hydrodynamics, then the current has to be the density of particles times the velocity. Right? The particles at any point in configuration space are all going the same way, so the flux of particles across a surface, or through a small surface, are going to be whatever, however many particles you've got there, the density times the velocity. Okay, so the equation for the velocity field should just therefore be the current divided by the probability density, and that would be this velocity field, and that's exactly what the Bohmian velocity field is. So because of this continuity equation, because this holds, if we set this velocity field, this is going to be the particle flux current, and therefore we're going to get equivariance, right? Because we know that in quantum mechanics, this equation leads to the conservation of probability. Is that clear? Any questions about that?
So you mentioned that if Q is the actual position,
right?
So why does it have the probability distribution? Because it is actually there.
Yeah, so that's why this is exactly the same question. So how I'm interpreting that is if I prepare the same state multiple times, in each case, there'll be some configuration space point. Let's look at the distribution of those configuration space points over all of those cases. That's what I mean by that in this case. Right. Okay, so that's where it comes from. So now let's look at the sort of very simplest case that you can imagine. So imagine that we just have a single particle in one dimension, and it starts out in a Gaussian wave packet like this. This is a Gaussian wave packet that's going to propagate towards the right. And again, if you go back to your undergraduate quantum mechanics textbook, the group velocity, the velocity with which the overall pattern of the Gaussian moves, is given by this in for free particle in quantum mechanics. Free particles in Gaussian wave packets in quantum mechanics, the wave packet spreads over time. So it moves to the right with this velocity, but there's also a spread in the width of the Gaussian. Okay, so you can actually analytically compute what the velocity field, the Bohmian velocity field, is in full generality. It's a bit of a pain of a calculation. So let me just tell you what happens. So if we consider a time scale such that this spreading is small, right? So if the time, let's just say t, I think, not t squared. If we consider times that are small compared to this spreading scale, then basically all of the de Broglie-Bohm velocities in this wave packet are the group velocity. They move, the particles inside the wave packet here will move along with the same velocity as the wave packet itself. So the particle gets dragged along with the wave packet at the group velocity. This is nice, because you probably read in your undergraduate quantum mechanics textbook that you should think of wave packets as representing localized particles, and that particles move at the group velocity. Well, this really does happen in Bohmian mechanics. Now, because of this spreading, it's not quite 100% true. A particle in the center of the wave packet moves with the group velocity. If you're slightly ahead of the center, then it gets accelerated a little bit to account for this spreading. And if you're over here, it gets decelerated a little bit over time. And that accounts for the spreading. But you can see the details of the full calculation in this paper if you want. OK. So now let's look at another stereotypical quantum mechanical experiment, the double slit. So what's going on here is that we have a model where, coming out of the slits, you have a wave function that can be divided into two components, one of which is a Gaussian coming out of this slit and another Gaussian coming out of that slit. And then they evolve and spread over time and interfere. During the time at which these two wave packets don't overlap very much, so that's when you're close to the slits, you can write the current approximately as two currents, one of which only involves the wave packet coming out of here and only locally affects the particles here, and similarly over there. And then when you have that situation, you just have a single wave packet like that, and you have individual currents, then the trajectories basically work out like they do in geometric optics, right? So the particle approximately travels normal to the wavefront. However, when you get overlapping, there are going to be cross terms in the current. So if we look at the form of the current, then there are going to be terms that come where you have psi 1 here and psi 2 here, psi b here and psi b prime here, and vice versa. Those terms will cause interference, and they'll cause the position of one particle to affect the position of, they'll cause both wave packets to influence the motion of the particle. And that's when you start to get these deflections, and this causes the sort of characteristic pattern of dark and light stripes that you get in a double slit experiment. Okay, so now, importantly, we need to talk about measurements, and this will speak to David's question. Right, because one of the important things we have to show is that when we do a measurement, we really get a definite outcome, and we get that with the quantum probabilities. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to divide our system into two subsystems, so a small system that we're measuring and the environment system, which is going to include the measurement device and anything else in the environment. So in Bohmian mechanics, even if those combined systems are in an entangled state, there's a sense in which I can assign a quantum state to the individual system. I just do it like this. I say, OK, well, this thing is a function of configuration space. Let me plonk in the actual configuration of the environment, the actual configuration that the environment is in. And this will now just give me a function on the configuration space of the system. This in Bohmian mechanics is called the conditional wave function. Now, conditional wave functions generally won't evolve according to the Schrodinger equation because basically, because of interference effects between wave packets associated with different values of the environment variables. But what you can do is, I mean, this is a la ordinary decoherence theory, right? So if there's decoherence into measurement states that are localized, so if the environment is, you know, if the different components, if it splits into two components which are localized functions in configuration space, and if that persists over time, that's what I mean by decoherence into localized environment states, then you will at least approximately get Schrödinger evolution for this guy. Okay, so here's how we're going to model the measurement device. So the environment, which in this case, let's take it to be the needle on this pointer. Okay, so the needle on this pointer consists of a large number of individual particles, which I've drawn, tried to draw here by points, and then a state in which the measurement device is registering zero outcome has all these things pointing over here, and where it's one, it has them pointing over there. So there's very little overlap in configuration space, approximately no overlap in configuration space between the quantum states, which represent those two outcomes. Even if they did look like they overlapped in physical space, all of these particles have a lot of internal degrees of freedom as well, right? So even states where, you know, you have some macroscopic system, but the individual particles in them are moving, jiggling around in different ways, that's going to cause a lack of overlap in configuration space, and that's what we need. Okay, so now in a stereotypical measurement interaction, if I start with my system in the superposition of two wave functions, which are eigenstates of the observable that I'm measuring, then over time, that will evolve into a superposition of the system and the measurement device where this component of the system is correlated with the zero component of the environment and similarly for the ones. That's what happens according to the Schrödinger equation in the stereotypical measurement interaction kind of thing. Okay. So let's suppose that the lack of overlap in position space between these two components persists in time. Okay, so let's suppose that these two pointer states are quite stable. They're not going to, you know, suddenly evolve back into the same state, partly because, you know, there are all sorts of things like radiation that bounces off the pointer and sort of goes off to infinity and contains information about where that pointer was. Okay, so because of the lack of overlap, the actual configuration of the environment either is in the support of this or in the support of that, not both, right? Or there may be a very small overlap, but almost every configuration space point can be associated either with being in one of these two components of the wave function. Now, by equivariance, the total configuration of the system has to obey mod squared probabilities, right? So the total support, so it will have to be in the support of here with this probability and in support of here with this probability. And that just follows from the fact that the configuration is always in the mod psi squared probabilities. Then if I put in the actual configuration here, the conditional state of the system will either be in one of these two wave packet, one of these two, wave functions for the system. If this lack of overlap persists over time, then these two individual components will each evolve according to the Schrödinger equation. Okay? The current will break down into two terms, the current for the whole system plus environment. The support of this current, this current will be zero. So the current associated with outcome zero will be zero in the support of this guy, and vice versa. There won't be any cross terms in the guidance equation because those two terms refer to different sections of configuration space. The environment partitions the configuration space into two parts. So when the environment configuration is in here, you'll be guided by this current, and when it's in here you'll be guided with that current. So what happens is that you're going to get an effective collapse, right? So after the measurement, you can just track this component or just track this component and just use the corresponding current, which corresponds to just calculating the current with this component on its own or with this component on its own. And that's going to give you the same predictions as if you track the whole thing. So in the Bohmian picture, all this entanglement in the global wave function of the universe persists over time, and we should really be tracking the wave function of the entire universe. But in this stereotypical decoherence kind of scenario, what actually happens is that you can get away with tracking one of the components and just the current of that component. So we get an effective collapse, but it's a mathematical trick for tracking the configuration of the system more easily. It's not that there's a fundamental collapse of the wave function of the universe. That's roughly the outline of how measurements work. Okay, so let me say one more thing. So let's assume that the measurement is some kind of an approximate position measurement. Okay, so what we're doing is we're dividing, let's say, space into two halves, and we're saying, are you on the left or are you on the right? Then the corresponding eigenstates of the system will also have no overlap. Okay, that won't be the case if we make some other kind of measurement, say a momentum measurement. Then the eigenstates have overlap in configuration space. So in that in this case, we can say that the initial configuration of the system was either in the support of this wave function or in the support of that wave function initially. And the measurement outcome is just a deterministic function of that. Okay, so for a position measurement done in this way, the pointer ends up just telling you what the Bohmian position is, basically. So if I do a position measurement by coupling the position to a macroscopic detector that decoheres in localized states in configuration space, then the outcome will be just whatever the Bohmian trajectory says it should be, where the Bohmian particle is. However, if you measure other observables, that's not true. And the initial, you can't think of the initial configuration of the system as belonging to one of the two eigenstates. Right? If they're two different momentum states, for instance, configuration doesn't tell you which of those two states it belongs to. And in that case, what happens is that which measurement outcome occurs is a function of both the configuration of the system and the configuration of the environment variables. And remember, both of those are mod psi squared distributed, right? So although we have global determinism, right, so that everything is the equations of motion are completely deterministic, they're not deterministic on the level of the system alone. So this is a distinction we make. So the theory is deterministic. The outcome's uniquely determined by whatever the ontic state of the system and measuring device is. But it's not outcome deterministic in the sense that we were talking about in the ontological models section, where we said lambda of the system uniquely determines the measurement outcome. That's not true, because it depends on the environment variables, and those are randomly distributed. Okay? So if you write this theory out as an ontological model, it won't look deterministic in that framework. It's also important to say that this kind of momentum measurement doesn't measure the Bohm momentum. Right? So there's a natural momentum of the trajectory, but that's not what gets tracked by a Bohmian, but by a standard quantum momentum measurement. Okay, because that would depend only on the system. All right, so now let's talk about spin. So I've previously only been talking about spinless particles. Particles obviously have spin degrees of freedom. There are several prescriptions for dealing with spin. Here's the one that Bell recommended. The idea is we're not going to say that if a particle's got spin, we're going to add a spin degree of freedom to the primitive ontology. Just going to keep it as particle positions. The idea is that if we consider, you know, the fact that what we see is always in kind of in position space, right? I don't see directly the spins of the particles in this desk over here. The idea is that you can get away with still just having positions. And spin is going to appear in the wave function, as it does in conventional quantum mechanics, and play a role in guiding the positions of the particles. But we're not going to endow each particle with an extra property called spin. OK, so this is really a minimal modification of the equation. So you can write a wave function including spin as a spinner, right? So just consider like a superposition like this as a column vector with the two components corresponding to spin up and spin down. So that's for a single particle. For n spinner half particles, you'd have a two to the n dimensional spinner vector like that. So spinner vectors, I'm going to denote with an upper, with a line on top of them. Now we have three types of vectors, right? We've got real space, 3D space vectors. We've got configuration space vectors, and we've got spinner vectors. Confusing. So all we do in the guidance equation is it's the same equation, but we now take an inner product over the spinner degrees of freedom, right? So this should be interpreted as the inner product on this space of those things. And that will, again, give me a function just of configuration space. And well, it's related to the probability current for spin particles with spin in exactly the same way as without spin. OK, so that's the very sort of straightforward treatment of how at least Bell recommended to do it. Of course, there are many other possible choices. You could add extra primitive ontic states for spin. In fact, you could have any complete orthonormal basis of your Hilbert space as representing the primitive ontology. It's been worked out how to do that. And if you have a discrete basis, then you need a stochastic guidance equation. Why? Because if I take just the spin up and spin down, whether I'm spin up or spin down in a Z basis, then somehow, if I'm in a spin up quantum state, the particle has to, with certainty, be in the spin up ontic state. But then as I rotate the particle, the probabilities change continuously, right? So at some point, I've got to jump to spin to the other spin direction. So you can write down a stochastic generalization of the guidance equation. That was also done by John Bell, but I'm not going to go into the detail. But there are various. The point is that there are various different prescriptions you could take. OK, so now what I want to do is go through some of the counterintuitive features of the Bolle-Bohm trajectories. So, you know, these trajectories, they're not classical trajectories, OK? So when do you get classical trajectories? You get them in precisely the kind of situation I was talking about, when you have decoherence of the environment into localized, into states that are localized in position space, in configuration space. Then you approximately follow the classical trajectories. Actually, for reasons which are exactly similar to the mathematics that has been talked about in the last couple of lectures. So in terms of reconstructing, you know, in terms of giving us a realist foundation for quantum theory, we've shown that quantum measurements will obey the quantum probabilities. This will imply that classical systems behave classically. The theory doesn't really owe us anything more than that. Okay. Now, you could even argue, of course, that since quantum mechanics and classical theories are different, the predictions are different, any trajectories which are going to reproduce quantum mechanics are going to have to do things which look funny, right, which look strange. Okay? They must differ from the classical ones in some situations. The question about this is only if the trajectories are sort of weirder than absolutely necessary to reproduce the quantum predictions. So are the Bohmian trajectories more strange than they ought to be? OK, so let's look at a few examples. So first of all, let's consider the case of a stationary state that happens to be real value. OK, so let's consider a stationary state, an eigenstate of a Hamiltonian, which evolves like this. Then what will happen is that the time dependence will drop out of the current the current will be a function of just this position eigenstate on its own. If this happens to also be a real valued function, then these two components of the current in the imaginary part are the same. The current will be zero everywhere. Right? So that happens actually for a lot of stationary states in many systems. Simple example is a particle in an infinite well where the wave function is just sinusoidal. So classically, if I had a particle with energy, this energy En, it would bounce back and forth between the walls with this velocity. And the Breuer-Bohm theory says that even if you're in a very highly excited state, all of the particles just stay put. Right? So they're initially psi squared, if I prepare this multiple times, I'll get particles at different points. But in each individual system, particles are just they just stay where they are. That's kind of strange. The classical intuition is that somehow these states represent particles that are bouncing backwards and forwards, not during Bohmian. Okay, so almost everything else that's weird about Bohmian mechanics follows from this thing called the no-crossing rule. So if you think about classical mechanics for a minute, in classical mechanics, the trajectories, possible trajectories in phase space don't cross each other. You don't get any crossings in phase space, except at points where you have singularities and things like that. This is because the equations of motion are second order. So the phase space point contains the two pieces of data that you need to specify a unique solution to the differential equations. Okay, so that means that each phase space point determines a unique future evolution. If you had a crossing in phase space, that wouldn't be the case, right? However, in de Broglie-Bohm theory, the guidance equation is first order. And there are two differential equations, one for the wave function and one for the particle. But the equation for the wave function doesn't depend on the particle configuration. There's no back action on the wave function. That just evolves according to Schrodinger evolution. So if I take two configuration space points with the same wave function, same initial wave function, then because I have a first order equation, it's enough to specify the configuration space point. So those are going to specify unique trajectories. Okay, so trajectories that are associated with the same wave function evolution can't cross each other in configuration space, not in phase space now. Right? And so again, this is a consequence of the sort of hydrogen dynamic way that we build things, where we had a unique velocity at each point in configuration space. Now, I should note here that if you have this stereotypical measurement interaction type of thing, then the configuration space points of the system alone can cross each other. It's only the global configuration space that where you can't have crossings. And each of these components refers to system configurations that correspond to distinct environmental configurations. Right, so you can get crossing the subsystems when you have decoherence into different environmental states that don't overlap in configurations. But in a situation where we have coherence and interference phenomena, we're going to get this no-crossing rule for the system. OK, so here's a funny thing that you can derive. OK, so let's suppose we have a superposition of two wave packets, one of which is traveling to the right and one of which is traveling to the left. And let's, for simplicity, assume that one is the mirror image of the other. Okay. So in quantum mechanics, these two things are going to come together. They'll interfere constructively in this case. It doesn't actually matter what phase relationship between them. So I could have destructive interference. It's just for illustrative purposes. And then they'll go apart. So remember, before we derived that if you just have a single wave packet, the particle goes along with that wave packet. So one of these wave packets will have the particle, the other one won't. The one which doesn't have the particle is often called an empty wave. What will happen in this situation is that the empty wave, when they interfere, will steal the particle from the occupied wave. It will always end up in the wave packet that it didn't start in, right? You can see this like qualitatively just by the no-crossing rule, right? Because the trajectory for a particle that starts here and the trajectory for a particle start here can't cross each other. If this one went like this and this one went like that, then there'll be a crossing in configuration space. But here, you can actually explicitly calculate it. When you have this mirror symmetry, it's easy to do. The point is that the current, probability current, or the particle current in Bohm theory is zero always at the origin. Okay, so that means that there's going to be a turning point of the velocity there. The way you can see that is that you can generally decompose the current into two terms where you know, each component of the wave packet we have a term like this for. Now, if you use this symmetry here, then when I take a derivative with respect to x of psi 2, I'll get a minus sign from the chain rule, and it'll be like psi 1. And from that, you can derive that the current associated with the terms associated with this with itself are just the negative of the 1, 1 terms, and similarly for these two terms, okay, except with a minus sign on the x. But when I evaluate that at, this is an odd function, so when I evaluate it at x equals 0, I'm going to get 0. So when you have a symmetry like that, you always get this feature where the empty waves will come and steal the particle. Let's think about the consequences of that for a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So let's consider a Mach-Zehnder interferometer where I removed the final beam splitter here. So what will happen in quantum mechanics is that half the time this detector will click and half the time that detector will click. Now, we normally, at least informally, although perhaps according to the Copenhagen interpretation it is something that we shouldn't do, we normally take the idea that if this detector clicks, then that's evidence that the particle went along this path in some sense. But the opposite is true in de Broglie-Bohm theory. In this situation, we have z-axis symmetry. So here I'm just doing a two-dimensional generalization of what happened above. I have perfect mirror symmetry here along the z-axis. So the phenomena that I had here, just in one dimension, will be reproduced in two dimensions. The z component of these two things will be opposite at all times. And so what will happen is that this wave packet will go up here, this one will go down there, but the empty wave will always steal the particle. So actually, if this detector clicks, then the particle went on this trajectory. Detector zero clicking tells you that you went on trajectory one, which is slightly strange. Okay. So maybe I don't have time to do this. I want to get through a bit more stuff. So the point of this is just that you can make this this a bit more surprising by kind of, if you do a measurement along this path, if you put a measuring device along that path that doesn't amplify into macroscopically distinct states in position space, And then you can have something like a particle spin over here, which gets flipped if the wave packet comes down this path. Okay. If you do that, then you can show that this effect still persists. So if you later measure that spin, it will tell you, oh, the particle went down here, but actually the Bohmian particle went up there. It's the same effect, but it's just a way of making it sort of a bit more dramatic, if you will. That's sometimes called surreal trajectories. But anyway, I don't have time to go into that in detail. Okay, what are we doing for time? Very badly, right?
Suppose I would put a spin 1/2 particle there, and it is up, and when a photon passes by, it switches to down. Doesn't that mean I'm going to entangle that electron with the photon?
Yeah, so what happens though is that it doesn't completely erase the coherence. If you look at this expression, you do lose these two interference terms, but these two terms are still opposite and cancel, right? So you still get that effect. What would happen if you had proper environmental decoherence is that these terms, is that you'd either have this term or that term, depending on the configuration of the environment. But if you still have overlap in the environment, then you still get both terms, and you still get cancellation. So it's true that some of these terms, that these terms drop out, but you still get that effect that the current is zero. You still get the node crossing rule.
Are you saying that orthodox quantum mechanics predicts that if the upper detector says spin, then it's spin down and de Broglie?
So in orthodox quantum mechanics, that spin measurement is perfectly correlated with which of those detectors fire. Just the predictions of quantum mechanics. And Bohmian mechanics predicts that too, but it's in some sense the empty wave that flips that flips the spin, not the particle. It's a funny effect, but that's what happens. But what happens is that the particle goes up here. If you get the spin flip over here, the particle is actually going along this trajectory, because it has to reproduce standard quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics says that this and the spin flip are perfectly correlated. So if this detects here, then there has to be a spin flip here. But somehow it's the interaction of the empty wave that's going down here with the spin that causes the spin to flip, not the interaction with the particle, because the particle's up here. I told you the Broglie-Bohm trajectories are weird. They're weird, right? And they have to violate classical intuitions, because we know that these experiments can't be explained with classical intuition. I've got a few minutes left. So let's just talk a little bit about Cauchy-Specker contextuality. Now, contextuality of the Cauchy-Specker variety occurs in de Broglie-Bohm because the outcome of an experiment isn't just depend on the configuration of the particle, but also on all the other variables. Right, in particular, the variables describing the environment and what the interaction Hamiltonian is. So it depends on a lot of stuff. So if we consider, for example, a Stern-Gerlach measurement of spin, then we can see from the no-crossing rule, so if I take the same Stern-Gerlach magnet, so this here is the spin-up outcome, this is a spin-down outcome. First of all, by the no-crossing rule, I know that particles that start up here have to go up. So some proportion of the particles have to go up and some have to go down. But because there's no crossings, I can't have one at the bottom that goes up to the top, right? So basically a proportion like mod alpha squared of the trajectories have to go up here and proportion mod beta squared have to go down here. But if I flip the Stern-Gerlach magnet by 180 degrees and I change which is the spin up and spin down outcome, right, by doing so, then it has to be the opposite. So here we have a case where a trajectory here that would previously have registered spin up now has to register spin down, right? This is because, again, of the no-crossing rule. So a Stern-Gerlach measurement on a spin-half particle, this is just a measurement on a two-dimensional Hilbert space, we'd normally think of it as. This is a situation in which you can't prove the Cauchy-Specker theorem. So in some sense, Bohmian mechanics is more contextual than would be implied by the Cauchy-Specker theorem. Okay. Maybe I'll take a... I'm going to get almost to the end of this. I don't know. I've got like four more slides. Do people want me to finish or stop?
Finish.
I have one vote for finish. If nobody else says anything, I'm going to finish. But, otherwise, I'll stop. Let me take a couple of minutes anyway. So the only property of the guidance equation that we needed to reproduce the quantum phenomena was this equivariance property. Sorry, this should be capital Qs here. These are refer to the actual configuration. So, you know, if I start in the quantum in this quantum equilibrium state, then I'll be like that at all times. So any other dynamics which is equivariant in that sense would do just as well. And here's an example of how you can change the equations and get the same. Providing you can add current terms like this to the currents for each particle, velocities for each particle, as long as this current is divergence-free. Right? So if you do that, bit like a gauge transformation, except here we're thinking of these particle trajectories as real. So it's funny. Okay, so there are other dynamics which do the job. You could also do other things. You can add more primitive variables, for example, the spin. You could do the whole thing in a different basis. Let's have real momenta, for instance. Or you could even, there are generalizations where you could even use a POVM to define your states of reality. And it's sort of a natural thing to do would be to use coherent states, right? To give, to say you have the coherent state over complete basis. One of those is occupied. That gives me a rough idea of both position and momentum. So why not do that? So there's many other things like that you could do. OK, so remember I said the quantum state's playing two roles. It's both a dynamical role and a probabilistic role. This is called the quantum equilibrium hypothesis. They're independent, so you could keep the guidance equation as it is, but set the probability density to anything else you like, right? And then evolve the equations of motion, and everything will be determined. Now, there is some evidence, particularly by some work done by people like Anthony Valentini, that under suitable coarse graining procedures like those of classical statistical mechanics, if you start with some other density, it relaxes to this quantum equilibrium density over time. So akin to the process of thermalization, equilibration statistical mechanics. So it would then be natural to posit that, well, maybe the universe actually started in a non-equilibrium configuration, not in this probability density, but something else. Perhaps they occurred in the early universe, and then we had sort of an equilibration process which brought us into this quantum equilibrium. Now, this would resolve some of the underdetermination, because you would now possibly be able to distinguish different dynamical equations like this one. But that would lead to the Bode's hypothesis. What you can show is that any time you're out of equilibrium, you would get effects like superluminal signaling in the theory. There is, at the ontological level, a violation of parameter independence that occurs in this theory. So if you could resolve the ontic states, the positions of the particles, better than this, then you would be able to use that to actually signal. Here's just a diagram of sort of how that works. So here, suppose you start in this probability density, and you sort of coarse grain a little bit, smooth it over time, you end up here. And this is what the mod psi squared probabilities look like for the state they use. This is just some numerical evidence that you end up getting things over time that look like the quantum probabilities. Yeah, we're nearly done. So obviously, you need to generalize this to relativistic physics, to quantum field theory. This brings its own problems. So for example, do I want to say that particles are real, or do I want to say that fields are real? Right? You could also have a mixed ontology where you have particle occupation numbers. Well, particle occupation numbers are discrete, so they require a stochastic generalization. You could have a mixture of the two effects. Like, so a relatively natural thing to do is say that fermions are particles, bosons are fields. Bosons are represented by fields, because then you would have the classical electromagnetic field coming out as a field, right? Now, these theories can't be fundamentally Lorentz invariant. So under the equilibrium hypothesis, the operational predictions will agree with quantum field theory, so they'll be Lorentz invariant. But the theories violate parameter independence. There will be superluminal signaling at the ontic level. And if you had this non-equilibrium idea, then these effects would actually be observable. Right? So in some sense, yes, you can do relativistic Bohmian mechanics, but you know, it's a highly non-local theory underlying that. OK, so this is the end. So what we can say is that the theory provides a coherent ontology as straightforward equations of motion. And it does save the phenomena, right? So that's great. The trajectories don't obey our common intuitions, but arguably they have to do that if they're going to reproduce quantum phenomena. But there are some sense in which they're arguably more weird than interpretation has to be according to what we've proved, right? So they're more contextual than what quantum mechanics requires. You can also show, you know, double slit trajectories exhibit non-local effects. Or Mach-Zehnder ones do. And we know that there are good like psi epistemic local explanations for that kind of thing. So if you take the equilibrium hypothesis as a postulate, it's kind of like a fine tuning. It's kind of like saying, okay, there are all these non-local effects, but I can arrange that they're going to be washed out by what my lack of knowledge about what the configuration of the system is. And that leads to these underdetermination ideas. So in my view, it's better to view that equilibrium as emergent, like in thermalization. That removes the underdetermination, but that leads to making the bold hypothesis that you should really expect to see Lorentz violation somewhere in the universe, which is a very bold hypothesis that I personally am not prepared to make. So overall, what I think is that this theory is a good counterexample to many exaggerated claims about the impossibility of things in quantum mechanics. So it's good to know about in detail, but I don't think it's the true story. But then I don't think any of the interpretations we have right now are the true story. OK, so thanks for letting me spend a little extra time. That's it for today. Any questions? Yeah. Yes.
I have a question about superluminal signaling.
Yeah.
So that shouldn't be a problem within non-relativistic quantum mechanics.
Sorry?
That shouldn't be a problem in non-relativistic quantum mechanics.
I mean, it's still the case in non-relativistic quantum mechanics that if I have a state which is a tensor product of two components, if I have even an entangled state and I make tensor product measurements on it, I can't use those to signal operationally. But it's still operationally true that we have that structure of no signaling even in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And then Bohmian mechanics says, even in that situation, there's superluminal signaling, right? So arguably, it's more of a problem in relativistic quantum mechanics because there you may well want fundamental Lorentz invariance. But even, it's like, I mean, the way I put it is like this. It's not, what's surprising about something like Bell's theorem is not that there are non-local influences. If there was straightforwardly superluminal signaling and non-local influences, we'd just all say, okay, Einstein was wrong. You know, that we have to do physics a different way. But what's funny about it is that we prove that there must be superluminal influences in situations in which you can't use them to signal. There's a tension there, right? It's like you don't really seem to break relativity, but you've proved that thing is there. So that's what I mean by a fine tune. It's an example of a fine tuning there. So it's that thing that's the tension in these kinds of theories. And you could say that for non-relativistic as well as relativistic theories. Yeah.
Can you go to the slide with the Cook-Hins Becker conditionality?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure why you called it Cook-Hins Becker. It's more like Rob's notion, because the basis you're measuring is the same.
The basis I'm measuring is the same, but it's you think about it, it's Cook-Hins Becker in the sense that this is a case of measurement contextuality and it's outcome determinism. There's outcome determinism here. Okay, that's why I'm calling it Cook-Hins Becker contextuality. It's very easy to prove that the Breuer bone violates, for example, preparation contextuality because non-contextuality, because as soon as you have a real quantum state, you got that, right? So
I guess my point is the contexts here are not different fine grainings of
yeah. So we can distinguish two types of context. There's context that can be represented in the quantum formalism, and then there's context that can't be represented in the quantum formalism. So if I do an experiment and wear two different colors of pullover, there's no representation in the formalism of quantum mechanics of that. But then if I prepare a density operator in terms of two different ensemble decompositions, that is represented in the quantum formalism. So that latter kind of contextuality, that's what we can prove that quantum mechanics must have. Because if there's no way of representing it in the formalism, then obviously you wouldn't be able to prove it. But Bohmian mechanics has even stronger kind of contextuality. So things that I can't even represent on the system as differences do display differences.
Right. Well, I guess that's why it feels like Rob's notion to me, because the contexts here are not something that are quantum mechanical, and the Cook-Hins vector, isn't it? Completely quantum.
Well, it's the same project. It's still the same projector receiving a different value in two different situations, but not in a way that quantum mechanics demands it must. All right.